direction I'd been coming from. Quorum High, which was part of the Unified School District, occupied a flat two-block stretch of land on the northeast side of town. The grass looked patchy and the flagpole was bare. The classrooms were dispersed among a number of low-slung outbuildings that appeared to be prefabricated, with walls you could probably pierce with an X-Acto knife. I counted 6 trees on campus, not enough to pass for landscaping, but sufficient to offer the occasional shallow puddle of shade. The administration building looked like the first story of something far more grand. Maybe the school was in the process of raising funds, driving everyone insane with endless telethons on the local TV station. People will pay big bucks to get their regular programs back. Sitcoms and soaps instead of all those amateur rock bands playing songs they've written without training of any kind. I parked in the lot in a space marked Visitor. I locked the car and trotted across the flattened grass to the entrance, pushing through the double glass doors and into the main corridor. It was dead quiet, though there must have been students somewhere on the premises. The portable classrooms outside weren't large enough to house the auditorium or the gym. I was guessing that a goodly number of classes were held in this building as well. I could smell sweat and hairspray, hormones and hot gym shoes, the scents of teen misery. Bad skin, no power, too few choices, too much sexual pressure, and not enough wisdom to see you through until you reached 18. How many lives were out of whack by then? Girls pregnant, guys dead in cars before the beer cans had quit rolling across the floorboards. Ahead of me, down the hall, I spotted a sign indicating the principal's office. I could feel my anxiety mount, as it had every day of my life during my high school years. I'd been so out of it, such a dork. I'd survived by rebelling, smoking dope and hanging out with other misfits like me. Here I was again, only all grown up, allegedly, crossing the threshold voluntarily, looking for answers to questions I'd never even dreamed of when I was young. The school secretary was in her early 30s with brown eyes and short silky hair the color of pecan shells. A gossamer array of freckles lay across her nose and upper cheeks. She was casually dressed, beige slacks, short-sleeved brown sweater, and flat-heeled shoes. Her laminated name tag read Adrian Richards, and under that, in smaller letters, Administrative Assistant. She got up when she saw me and came to the counter.
May I help you?
I hope so, I said. I'm a private investigator from Santa Teresa. I'm working with a couple of police detectives trying to identify a homicide victim who died in August of 69.
You mean here?
We're not sure. I took a brief time out, giving her a verbal sketch of the girl we were trying to identify. We've been down here talking to local dentists, hoping to locate her through her old dental records. I just talked to Dr. Nettleton. He thinks she was a patient, but he can't remember her name. I thought if I could talk to a couple of teachers, my description might ring a bell. Do you have any idea who was on the faculty back then? She stared at me blankly. I could almost see her compute the possibilities. I thought she might speak, but her expression shut down and she dropped her gaze.
You'd have to talk to Mr. Eichenberger. He's the principal. All our student records are confidential.
I don't want her records. I just want to know her name.
Mr. Eichenberger doesn't allow us to give out information like that.
You mean you know her? Her cheeks had begun to color.
Of course not. I'm talking about school policy.
I stared at her, annoyed. Maybe, as administrative assistant, she was unaccustomed to people talking back. I'd be lucky if I didn't end up in detention myself.
I don't understand the problem. Mr. Eichenberger's the only one authorized to discuss the students' files.
Fine. Is he available?
I'll check. But I'd have to see proper identification first.
I removed my wallet from my shoulder bag and opened the flap to show the photocopy of my license. I passed it across the counter.
May I take this?
As long as I get it back.
Just a moment.
She crossed the office, approaching a closed door that bore the nameplate, Lawrence Eichenberger, Principal. She knocked once and went in. After perhaps a minute, the door opened and Mr. Eichenberger emerged with Adrian Richards right behind him. She handed me my wallet and then returned to her desk, where she busied herself with paperwork so she could eavesdrop without appearing interested. Mr. Eichenberger was a man in his early 60s with sparse, soft-looking white hair, glasses, and a bulbous nose. His complexion looked sunburned, and I picked up the scent of his aftershave, which smelled like incense. He wore a vivid blue dress shirt, a dark sweater vest, and a hand-tied bow tie. His manner was officious, his expression suggesting he was hell-bent on thwarting me.
"I understand you have a problem with one of our students."
"Not quite," I said. Mentally, I could feel my eyes cross. No wonder I'd hated high school, where I'd been wholly at the mercy of guys just like him. I went through my entire explanation again, feigning a patience I didn't really feel. Mr. Eichenberger said,
"Miss Milburn, let me make something clear. I've been here since the mid-60s. As a matter of fact, I'm retiring in May. I came to the job when I was 40, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. I don't mean to brag, but I remember just about every student who's come through those doors. I make it my priority to know who they are and what they're about. That's what these kids need. Not a buddy or a pal. They need guidance from adults with their best interests at heart. We're in the business of getting these kids shaped up to face the real world. They need skills, reading and writing primarily, all in preparation for productive, well-paid work. If they're not college material, we make sure they find trades. Truancy, gangs, drug problems. We don't see much of that here, despite our proximity to Los Angeles."
I flicked a look over my shoulder. Were we being filmed? It's not that his sentiments weren't admirable, but the spiel sounded canned and had nothing to do with me. "Excuse me, but is this relevant?" He seemed to collect himself as though recovering from a momentary lapse of consciousness.
"Yes. Well, you were talking about a student. It would help if you'd give me the details. I can't be of assistance without that."
Ever obliging, I repeated my tale while his assistant moved papers randomly across her desk. Before I could finish my account, Mr. Eichenberger shook his head.
"Not here. Not during my administration. You might try Lockerbie. That's the alternative high school."
"Really, I didn't know there was one."
"It's over on the Kennedy Pike, a white frame building across from the town cemetery. You can't miss it."
"Is there someone in particular I should ask for?"
"Mrs. Bishop is the principal. She might be able to help."
"You didn't know the girl yourself?"
"If I had, I'd say so. I wouldn't withhold information in a murder investigation."
"What about your assistant?"
"Mrs. Richards wasn't working here back then."
"Too bad. I thought it was worth a try," I said. I took out a business card and made a note of the motel number on the back. "I'm at the Ocean View for the next couple of days. I'd appreciate a call if you think of anything that might help."
"You mentioned a foster family. I'd try social services."
"Thanks. That's a good suggestion. I'll do that." I decided not to make another move until I'd brought Dolan up to speed. For the second time that morning, I was headed back to the motel. I left the car in the parking space in front of his room and gave a rap at his door. From inside, I caught the muffled sounds of the blaring television set. Dolan must not have heard me because he didn't answer my knock. Head tilted against the door, I waited and then tried it again. No deal. I turned and stared off across the parking lot toward the office. I let my eyes stray to the alcove that housed the soft drink and Coke machines. No sign of him. I knocked again, this time sounding like the ATF at the outset of a drug raid. Maybe he was in the shower or otherwise indisposed. I crossed the parking lot to the office and poked my head in the door. The desk clerk, a girl in her 20s, was sitting on a swivel stool flipping through a copy of People magazine. I'd interrupted her in the middle of an article about Princess Di. The clerk was dark-haired, pretty in a sulky sort of way, with a mouth way too wide. Her lipstick was dark red, and her lashes were so thick I thought they must be false. She was wearing a navy skirt and white blouse, topped by a smart red blazer with a phony crest on the patch pocket. The outfit must have been provided by the motel because it didn't look like anything she'd have worn without the threat of being fired. To compensate, she'd shortened the skirt and left the top three buttons of her blouse undone. She was chewing gum, a habit I'd been warned against when I was in 10th grade.
My French teacher swore it made you look like a cow, and I haven't chewed gum since. I hadn't even liked the teacher, but the admonition stuck. I said, "Sorry to bother you, but I'm wondering if you've seen the fellow from room 130. I know he's expecting me, but he doesn't answer his door." She leaned over and checked the register, flipping back a page. While she did this, she pushed her tongue through the wad of gum until it bulged like a small pink lung being extruded through her lips. "You're talking about the old guy?" "He isn't old," I said, offended. "Yeah, right. The day he checked in, he got an AARP discount, 15% off. You can't get that unless you're old. You have to be 50 at least." "I'm 50 myself." She said, "Far out. You look 40. She blew a bubble and popped it to punctuate her point. She looked at me. "Oops, sorry. You were kidding, right?" "Never mind. I asked for that," I said. "Did he leave the motel for some reason?" "He went out for cigarettes, but I saw him come back." "How long ago was that?" "Hour. He stopped by to pick up messages, and then he went to his room." "Had any calls come in?" "Ask him yourself, you're such a pal." "Ring his room for me, okay?" "Sure." She picked up the phone, blowing another bubble as she punched the number in. It must have rung 15 times. "He must have gone out again. A lot of old people get antsy, too much energy, have to be on the go or it drives them nuts." "I appreciate your assessment. Can you come with me to his room and use your key?" "Nope. I'm here by myself and I can't leave the desk. Why don't you go around the back and bang on his bathroom window? He might be on the pot." I didn't like this at all. I returned to his room and knocked again about as loudly as the villagers at Frankenstein's castle door. Nothing. I circled the building, counting off the intervening rooms, until I reached one I assumed was his. All the bathroom windows were too high off the ground to do me any good. I went back to his front door and stood there, undecided, while I thought about life. Why wasn't he answering? I reached for my shoulder bag and pulled out my wallet. In the windowed compartment under my driver's license, I keep a simple set of lockpicks. This was not the battery-operated device I own that opens just about anything. I'd left that one at home, primarily because if I happened to get caught with it, the cops would take a dim view. What I had in hand was a set of the old-fashioned picks, a little hook and a tiny torque wrench, for occasions such as this. In my bag I also carry a pin light and a folding screwdriver, neither of which would be necessary for today's B&E. I knocked one more time and called Dolan's name in bullish tones. The guy in the next room opened his door and stuck his head out.
"Hey, keep it down for cripe's sake. And while you're at it, you can tell that jerk to turn off his TV set. It's been blasting since 10 o'clock, and I'm sick of it. Some of us have to work."
"Sorry, he's handicapped," I said, and tapped my ear. "Severe hearing deficit, the poor guy." The man's expression shifted from annoyance to something less.
"Oh, I didn't realize."
"That's okay. People treat him badly all the time. He's used to it." I waited until he disappeared, and then I set to work. In movies, thieves tend to pop the locks in no time flat, often with the use of a credit card, a method I avoid. I don't trust the process. I knew a guy once whose credit card snapped off in the door he was trying to open. A neighbor spotted him breaking in and called the cops. When he heard the sirens approach, he hightailed it out of there, leaving half his card behind. The cops picked up his surname and the last 6 digits of his account. He was busted within a day. In reality, picking locks takes practice, great patience, and no small measure of dexterity. Though most lock mechanisms are similar, there are variations that would drive the novice burglar insane. It usually takes a few tries. I manipulated my little torque wrench with one eye on the parking lot. If Dolan was out, I didn't want him to catch me breaking into his room. And I was not all that keen on having the cops called if one of the other occupants was watching me from behind the drapes. At the same time, if he was in there, it was time to find out what was going on. I felt the last gate give way. I turned the knob, pushed the door open, and stepped in. "Lieutenant Dolan?" He was lying on the bed, fully dressed, his shoes off. He turned toward me.
His breathing was shallow and his face was a pasty gray. I flipped off the TV and crossed the room. His voice was hoarse and raspy.
Heard you knocking, but I was in the bathroom being sick. I'm not doing so good.
I can see that. You look awful. Are you having chest pains? Up close, I could see a fine sheen of clammy sweat on his forehead and cheeks. He shook his head almost imperceptibly.
Tightness across here. Hard to breathe. Feels like an elephant sitting on my chest.
Oh, shit. I picked up the phone and dialed 911. Chapter 16. The emergency medical services crew seemed to take forever, though in truth it was no more than 6 minutes. I alerted the front desk and then waited in the parking lot so I could flag them down. I heard the sirens before I saw the fire department rescue van speed into view. I waved and the vehicle veered toward me and pulled in with a chirp of brakes. The woman driver and two other EMS techs emerged wearing bright yellow jackets with fire department written across the backs. They carried their equipment with them as they followed me into Dolan's room. I stood to one side, watching as the two guys moved the furniture aside, clearing space to work. Their manner was efficient but conversational, taking care not to further alarm Dolan, who was doubtless already aware of the depth of trouble he was in. One tech loosened his shirt and then placed a stethoscope against his chest. He took Dolan's pulse and jotted notes on his clipboard, then attached a blood pressure cuff, pumped it, and took a reading, his gaze fixed on his watch. He asked Dolan a series of questions, designed to assess the symptoms and events preceding the episode. I was surprised to hear Dolan admit he'd experienced something similar the night before, though the feeling had been less pronounced and had passed within minutes. The woman tech stepped in. She administered 2 sublingual tabs of nitroglycerin and then started an IV line while the third technician secured an oxygen cone across Dolan's nose. I went outside. A minute later, the crew emerged from the room. Dolan had been loaded onto a gurney. They rolled him as far as the back doors of the ambulance, which they opened to slide him into the rear. A few people passing through the parking lot paused to stare, but most moved on as soon as they realized what was happening. I appreciated their discretion. It's hard enough to be ill without feeling as though you've made a spectacle of yourself. One tech climbed into the van with Dolan. The rear doors were slammed shut. The hospital was 7 blocks away. I got directions from the second tech before he got in the cab of the van on the passenger side. The woman took the wheel again. She backed out and made a beeline for the street, sirens warbling, bar light flashing. I made sure Dolan's motel room was locked and followed in his car. When I arrived, the ambulance had already pulled into the emergency entrance. I parked in the main lot, and by the time I entered the waiting room, he'd been rolled into the rear. I spoke to the desk clerk, telling her who I was. She asked me a few questions about Dolan, making me aware how little I really knew about him. I told her he had insurance coverage through the STPD, and she said she'd pick up the remaining data from him. She got up and left her desk, clipboard in hand, indicating that the ER doctor would be out as soon as she was finished with him. I took a seat in the waiting room, which was spare and reasonably pleasant, pale green carpet, fake plants, and piles of tattered magazines. An assortment of children's toys was scattered on the floor. Lines of interlocking chairs had been arranged, cotillion fashion, around the edges of the room. In the corner, the face of a television set was blank. Someone had brought in Easter decorations, a basket filled with plastic eggs nestled in impossibly green paper grass. I wasn't even sure when Easter fell this year, but it was doubtless coming up soon, unless these were left from last year. 2 patients came in while I was waiting, a man with superficial contusions and abrasions from a bike accident, judging from his shaved legs and his bun-hugging spandex shorts, and a woman with her right ankle sandwiched between ice packs. Both were taken into examining rooms in the rear, but probably placed on hold while the doctors dealt with Dolan. Outside, the sun was shining and the town of Quorum was going about its business, as though nothing unusual had occurred. It was odd having a medical emergency in the middle of the day. Somehow, in my life, crises of this sort always seemed to happen in the dead of night. I couldn't tally the number of times I'd been sitting in waiting rooms like this one, while outside, city streets were deserted and shrouded in darkness. Restless, I left my seat and wandered into the hall, where I asked a passing nurse for the nearest payphone. I was directed to the hospital lobby, two long corridors away. I dialed Stacy's home number, charging the call to my credit card. Two rings later, he was on the line, and I was filling him in.
How's he doing?
Don't know. I haven't talked to the doctor yet. I wish I'd busted into his room when I first got there. I'm telling you, Stacy, his face was gray. He should have dialed 911 himself, but I think he was in denial. You know him.
This is ridiculous. You can't do this alone. I'm coming down.
Don't be silly. You're not well yourself. Just stay where you are. I've got enough on my hands.
I'm fine. Didn't Dolan tell you? The doc showed my x-rays to some big muckety-muck, and she says the shadow's insignificant. I forget now what they call it, but it's bullshit. Biopsy came back negative, too, so I got a clean bill of health.
Are you serious?
Of course. Why would I lie about a thing like that? I'm in remission. At least for now.
Lucky you didn't blow your brains out last week. Wouldn't you be pissed?
I just wish I hadn't got rid of all my personal possessions.
I could have told you as much.
Speaking of which, I'd like to have my family photos back.
Forget it. Find another bunch. Those are mine.
Come on now, Kinsey. I'll get duplicates made.
Quit wheedling. I don't want duplicates. I want those. Anyway, you shredded Cousin Mortimer, and he was my favorite.
You never even met him.
I know, but he had a good face.
You're tough.
A deal's a deal.
How about joint custody? Shared visitation. 1 week on, 1 week off.
Maybe, I said. You shouldn't have been in such a hurry.
At least I had the good sense not to shred my tax returns. I could be in jail for life, however much of it I got left.
What about your clothes?
Those went last week. I'll have to scour the Goodwill thrift store and buy 'em back.
Oh, ye of little faith. Dolan swore you'd be fine. You should have listened to him.
What does he know? The man's a mess. Didn't I tell you he was heading for another heart attack? Talk about a time bomb.
I know. I told him the same thing, but there was no stopping him. What about you? Are you really feeling okay?
Terrific, full of beans. I'm determined to come down. Don't know how I'll get there, but I'll find a way.
The doctor's letting you drive?
Of course, it's no business of hers. Problem is, I sold my car and let my license lapse.
Oh, no.
Well, I didn't want to take the test again. I was sure I'd be dead.
What about the lease on your house?
Shit! I'd forgotten about that. Healthy, but homeless. Oh, what a turn of events. By the way, did Dolan tell you what happened here?
We never had a chance to talk.
Triple homicide this morning. Woman, her boyfriend, and her kid shot to death. The ex-husband's fled into the backcountry where he's hiding out. All the SO guys have been pulled into the search. This guy's a wilderness expert, a paramilitary type. No telling how long it's going to take to flush him out. Forensics is still at the crime scene, which means they won't get to us again until they wrap that up. Could be days.
So why hang around down here? Once Dolan's out, I can drive us home in his car, and that'll save you the trip.
No way. I'm bored to tears up here. I got cabin fever so bad I'm about to go insane. Besides, if you two come home, we'll just have to turn around and go back again.
Assuming there's a link between the Mustang and Jane Doe, I said.
Trust me, it's there, and Dolan thinks so, too. You've been in business as long as we have. You develop a feel for these things. We're getting close.
Actually, I'd agree. I talked to a dentist this morning who remembered her. Someone like her, at any rate. He thinks she was one of the last patients he treated before he had to retire. The guy's 93 now and couldn't give me the name, but everything else he says seems to fit. I checked with the principal at Quorum High, and he referred me to the alternative high school for problem kids. I haven't had a chance to deal with that. I just stopped by the motel to give Dolan the news when I found him in the throes of this heart attack.
You hang on till I get there, then we'll put our heads together and decide what's next. How will I find you?
Oh, I'll be around somewhere. If I'm not at the motel, you can try me here. You know Dolan's car. Just keep an eye out for that. This town's so small, you can hardly miss.
Let me get a pencil and paper and you give me that address. As soon as I find wheels, I'll be on my way.
I gave him the name and address of the motel. He said,
Do me a favor and reserve a room in my name.
Why not take Dolan's? He's already forked out the bucks for it.
Good plan. Let's do that.
While we're at it, I need you to do me a favor. Could you stop by my apartment and pick up my leather jacket before you hit the road? It's hanging in my downstairs closet. I'll tell Henry to let you in, and he can show you where it is.
It's that cold?
To me it is. You better be prepared. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw a woman in scrubs come out of the treatment area with a manila folder in hand. I think the doc just showed. I'll call you back if there's anything to report. Dr. Flannery, the ER physician, was in her late 40s, small, with short, pale brown hair, a broad forehead, thin lips, and deep lines in her face. Her nose was a raw pink, as though she'd blown it a few times since she applied her makeup. She had a tissue in her pocket, and she dabbed at it before she held her hand out.
Sorry, allergies. I'm Dr. Flannery. Are you Mr. Dolan's friend?
We shook hands. Kinsey Milhone. It's actually Lieutenant Dolan. She checked his chart.
So it is.
How's he doing?
He's been stabilized, but he has a serious left coronary arterial blockage. We'll be admitting him as soon as his paperwork's done. I've spoken to his cardiologist in Santa Teresa, and he suggested a cardiac surgeon he knows in Palm Springs. Dr. Beckler's on his way now. As soon as he's seen the patient and reviewed the EKG, the two of them will talk. I'm guessing they'll insert a stent. The choice is Lieutenant Dolan's, but that's what I'd do if I were in his shoes.
I made a face.
They'll open up his chest?
The doctor shook her head.
They'll run a catheter through a small incision in his left inguinal area and go up through the vein.
How long will he be in?
That depends on his progress. Not as long as you'd think. 2 days.
Can I see him?
Of course. I've plugged him full of morphine, so he's feeling no pain. The effect is about the same as a 4-martini lunch.
Not unusual for him.
So I gathered. We had a little chat about that. I told him the smoking and heavy drinking would have to stop. He has to clean up his act around food as well. If you eat like he does, you should do the same yourself. QPs with cheese?
He ratted me out?
She smiled. Make sure we know how to reach you. He's listed you as next of kin, which means you're cleared for visits if you keep it brief. You want to follow me?
I tagged after her as she pushed through the door and padded down the highly polished corridor.
When we reached Dolan's cubicle, she pulled aside the curtain on its overhead track. I have a visitor for you.
Dolan mumbled a reply.
Dr. Flannery held up 5 fingers, signaling a 5-minute visit. I indicated I understood, and she withdrew. I looked down at Dolan. How are you feeling? His eyes were closed, and he had a goofy smile on his face. His color had improved. He was stretched out on the table, his upper body draped with a cotton coverlet. His shoes were off, and the toe of one sock was pulled up to form a little cap, which made him look like a kid. He was still on oxygen, attached to a bank of machines that monitored his vital signs. He had an IV line in each arm. A bag of clear liquid had been hung on one pole, and I counted 15 drips. He began to snore. I took his hand, wagging it.
How are you doing?
He opened his eyes.
I'm good.
You were in big trouble, you dork. You should have called for help.
Heard you knock. Couldn't move. Glad you got in.
He spoke carefully, as though his lips had been injected with Novocaine. Me and my little key picks. Don't tell. His eyes closed again, and he put a finger to his lips. I said, I put a call into Stacy and told him where you were. He says his x-rays are clear and he's coming down.
Said the same to me. No point arguing.
Tell me about it. I tried to talk him out of it, but he was adamant. I figured as long as you're stuck in here, he might as well pitch in. We can't do much for now, but maybe we can stir things up. I'm hoping forensics will come up with something good. I think we'll put him in your room if I can have the key.
Hang on.
Dolan revived himself long enough to fumble in his pants pocket and extract his key. I tucked it in my shoulder bag, thinking I'd stop by and pick up my typewriter before Stacy arrived. The desk clerk appeared at the curtain with a plastic hospital bracelet and a sheaf of documents affixed to a clipboard.
"I have your jewelry, Lieutenant Dolan. I just need your signature, and you'll be on your way."
He roused himself, lazily gestured her in.
"Sign away my life," he turned to me. "You okay on your own?"
"Don't worry about me. You take care of yourself and get some rest. I'll stop by this evening. You behave."
"Good deal."
Before I left Quorum General, I put a call through to Henry. He was out. I left a message on his machine telling him about Dolan's heart attack. I also mentioned that Stacy'd be stopping by. I told him where my jacket was and said I'd call later when there was more to report. It was 1:35 when I emerged from the hospital and returned to the parking lot. Oh, I hadn't realized how tense I was until I'd unlocked the car door and slipped behind the wheel. I took a good deep breath and did a neck roll. Anxiety was roiling through my body now that I was on my own. I hadn't realized how dependent I'd become on Dolan. It was nice to compare notes, nice to share meals, even fun to knock heads. My attachment didn't contain a shred of romance, but it did trigger a longing to be connected to someone. I'd trained with two old guys who taught me the business many years before. Maybe it was them I missed. I flipped through my note cards. The next obvious move was to chat with the principal at the alternative high school. I wish Dolan were on hand so he could handle it. Though I hated to admit it, he'd be subjected to a lot less guff. Mano a mano. Once he flashed that badge of his, people tended to respond. I picked up my mini-map and located the Kennedy Pike, then fired up the Chevy and pulled out of the lot. On the way down Main Street, I detoured into a filling station and pumped gas into the tank. I stood there clutching the pump, watching the gallons go in while the total sales price went up. The process took so long, I thought the tank must have sprung a leak. I'm accustomed to my VW with its gas tank the size of a bucket of paint. $29.46 later, I nosed out of the station and turned right. Once I reached Kennedy Pike, I drove west, scanning for sight of the cemetery and the white frame structure across the street from it. This section of Quorum was made up of endless, flat, empty fields, stitched together with lines of trees that served as windbreaks. When I finally spotted the cemetery, it looked as flat as the fields around it. There was only a smattering of visible headstones. Most were laid flat in the ground. I could see a few concrete benches and a sparse assortment of plastic bouquets that had been left near graves. The surrounding fence was iron and without ornament. Square brick support posts appeared at 15-foot intervals. There were 7 full-size trees of an indeterminate type, but the branches hadn't leafed out yet and the limbs looked frail against the April sky. Just beyond the cemetery entrance and across the street, I saw the Lockerbie Alternative High School. I wondered if the students made the same melancholy association. From youth to death with only a stone's throw between. When you're of high school age, the days go on forever, and death's little more than a rumor at the end of the road. Dolan and I knew death was just a heartbeat away. I parked in the lot and followed the walkway to the front porch, up a flight of wide wooden steps. This must have been a farmhouse once upon a time. It still carried an air of small rooms and cramped hopes. I let myself into the foyer where 8 kids were sprawled on the floor with sketchbooks, doing pencil drawings of the staircase. The teacher glanced up at me and then continued moving from student to student, making brief suggestions about perspective. From upstairs, I could hear another class in progress. Laughter trickled down the treads like leaking water. I don't remember anything funny from my high school days. To my right, the former parlor served as the main office, complete with the original fireplace. The hearth and surround were dark red brick, and the whole of it was topped with a dark mahogany mantelpiece. There was no counter separating the reception area from the office secretary, whose desk had been arranged facing the wide bay window. She interrupted her typing to turn and look at me. She seemed pleasant, dark-haired, plump, probably in her 40s, though it was hard to tell. When she said, "Yes, ma'am," several dimples appeared in her cheeks. She pulled out a chair and patted the seat. I crossed the room and sat down, introducing myself. "I'm looking for Mrs. Bishop."
"She's in district meetings all day, but maybe I can help. I'm Mrs. Markham. What can I do for you?"
"Here's the problem," I said, and launched into the tale. I'd told it so often that I had it down pat, the search for Jane Doe's identity in 50 words or less. For the umpteenth time, I described Jane Doe and the series of interviews that had led me to Lockerbie. "Do you remember anyone like that?"
"Not me, but I've only been here 10 years. I'll ask some of the teachers. Mrs. Puckett, who teaches typing, doubles as the guidance counselor. She'd be the one who'd recognize the girl, if anyone did. Unfortunately, she's out today. We all get a mental health day every couple of months. She'll be in first thing tomorrow morning, if you want to come back."
"If she does recognize the girl, would you have her record somewhere?"
"Not going back that far. We had a fire here 8 years ago. Between the smoke and water damage, we lost the majority of our files. It's a wonder the whole place didn't go up in flames. The fire department saved us. They were here in 7 minutes and knocked it down in 30 before it had a chance to spread."
"How'd it happen?"
"Fire chief said electrical. We had wiring that dated from the original construction, 1945. He said it was a wonder it hadn't happened before. Now we have smoke detectors, heat detectors, and a sprinkling system. The works. We're lucky we weren't wiped out. Happily for us, there weren't any injuries or loss of life. Paperwork. Who cares? It accumulates faster than I can file it."
"The kids like it here?"
"They seem to. Of course, we're a magnet for the troublemakers. Dropouts, truants, delinquents. We get them when everyone else gives up. We only have a handful of teachers, and we keep the classes small. Most of our students do poorly in an academic setting. Basically, they're good kids, but some are slow, short attention spans. They're easily frustrated, and most of them suffer from poor self-images. With a regular high school curriculum, they lose heart. Here, the emphasis is practical. We cover the basics, reading, writing, and math, but we teach them how to write a resume, how to dress for a job interview, simple etiquette. Art and music, too, just to round them out."
"Sounds like something every school should do."
"You'd think so, wouldn't you?"
The phone on her desk rang, but she made no move. "You want to answer that?"
"They'll try back. I'm often out of the office, and they've learned."
"You have a business card?"
"Sure." "Why don't you give me a number? I'll try to reach Betty Puckett and have her give you a call."
"That'd be great." I took out a card and jotted down the name of the motel, the phone number, and my room number on the back. "I appreciate this."
"I can't swear she'll know the girl, but if she was ever a student here, I promise you Betty dealt with her."
"One more question. Dr. Nettleton seemed to think this girl was in a foster home, so I'm wondering if social services might help."
"I doubt it. They closed that office years ago, and I have no idea how you'd locate the old files. It'd be Riverside County, but that's as much as I know. You'll have a battle on your hands. They're worse than schools are about access to records, especially on a juvenile."
"Too bad. I had hopes, but I guess not."
"Sorry."
"I'll figure it out eventually. It's just a question of time." When I left Lockerbie, I was no better informed, but I was feeling encouraged. Once in the car again, I sat for a moment, beating out a little rhythm on the steering wheel. Now what? In the confusion of the moment, I hadn't thought to ask Dolan what he'd learned from the Quorum PD and the sheriff's office about the old missing persons reports. I'd ask him when I went to visit. I did a mental check of our list. The only item we hadn't covered yet was the issue of the tarp and whether one had been stolen at the time the Mustang was taken. I started the car and backed out of the slot, took a left on the Kennedy Pike, and returned to town. The McPhee's red brick ranch house looked deserted when I arrived, doors shut, curtains drawn, and no cars in the drive. I passed the house, cruising slowly, and at the next intersection did a U-turn and drove back. I parked across the street. I disliked the idea of seeing Rule again, but who else could I ask about the tarp? While I'd remained largely in the background during the impounding of the Mustang, he'd still associate me with his loss of face. I sat and studied the house, wondering if I could handle the question by phone. Chicken shit idea. Where possible, it's always better to deal in person. I was on the verge of taking off, postponing the visit until later in the day, when an approaching car slowed and turned into the drive. Edna. Once she turned off the engine, I could see her fussing in the front seat, gathering packages. After a bit of maneuvering, she got out with her purse over her shoulder, a grocery bag in one hand, and two department store carryalls clutched in the other. She pushed the door shut with one hip and moved to the rear of the car, setting down the carryalls while she opened the trunk. She placed her purse and the grocery bag on the driveway, reached into the trunk, and removed several additional grocery bags. I could see her debate whether she could manage everything in one trip or if she'd be forced to make two. I took the opportunity to get out of my car and cross the street at a trot. "Hi, Edna. Kinsey, can I give you a hand?" She looked up with surprise, coloring slightly at the sight of me. "I can manage." "Oh, there's no sense in making two trips. Why don't I take these and you can handle the rest?" I leaned forward and picked up her purse, one grocery sack, and the two large paper carryalls. "You must have spent all morning running errands."
"The family's coming for supper, and I'm running late. I want to get a pot roast in the oven."
Her demeanor had softened, though she seemed ill at ease. Good manners apparently took precedence over any discomfort she felt at my reappearance on the scene. Rule would have cut me dead, but the removal of the Mustang had little to do with her. It had been sitting in the garage for years anyway, and she was probably tired of his procrastination. His collection of classic cars must have seemed like a lousy investment, since he'd apparently made no effort to restore even one of them. I followed her along the driveway to the back gate, and then, since she didn't protest, I continued up the porch steps and through the back door. I put her purse on the Formica counter, waiting to see where she wanted the other bags. The red, white, and blue color scheme was like a tone poem to Americana. I took the time to let my gaze rest on every surface. "What time will Rule be home?" She placed her bags on the kitchen table.
"Soon, I guess. The rest of them, Cornell and his wife and kids and my daughter, are supposed to come at 6. You can put those over there."
And she gestured toward the window seat. I left the grocery sack on the kitchen table and crossed to the window seat, where I placed the department store carryalls. I moved aside a couple of pillows and the patchwork quilt and perched uninvited. I glanced at my watch. "It's almost 2 now. Do you mind if I wait?"
"I'm not sure that's a good idea. Rule's been upset, and I don't want anything to set him off again."
She began to put groceries away, leaving out the items she intended to use. A mammoth cellophane-wrapped chuck roast that looked like the whole back end of some unidentified beast. Onions, carrots, potatoes, fresh green beans, brown and served rolls. She looked at me.
"Did you need him for anything in particular? You know, he's madder than spit. There's nothing he hates more than someone trying to put one over on him. You and that detective should have told him the truth."
"We told Cornell why we were here. He could have mentioned it himself. We're talking about a murder. What difference does it make if Rule's mad?"
"Nonetheless..."
"Nonetheless what?"
"He won't be happy if he finds you here."
"Maybe you can help me and I'll be on my way."
"What do you want?"
"We're wondering if someone took one of his tarps at the time the car was stolen." She paused to think about that and then shook her head.
"Not that I recall. He never said anything. I suppose I could ask him and get in touch with you later on."
"You'd be doing him a service, especially if it turns out the Mustang was used to abduct the girl." Edna laid a hand against her chest.
"You can't seriously believe he had anything to do with it."
"It's not up to me." Her anxiety was infectious. I stood up, suddenly eager to be gone. As I picked up my shoulder bag, my glance fell on the red, white, and blue quilt folded and consisted of a series of patches stitched together in a traditional log cabin pattern. in repeat rows running along the diagonal. The fabric was a print of dark blue daisies, a dot of red in each center on a white background. I must have made a sound because Edna looked at me, saying,
"What? Where did you get this?" "That was given to me by Justine's mother, Medora, Cornell's mother-in-law. Why?"
"I need to talk to her." Chapter 17. I stood on the front steps of Medora Sanders' house, a modest stucco box with a shallow overhang that served to shield the small concrete porch. The exterior was painted dark gray. The wood trim had shed flakes of white paint like dandruff on the shrubs planted along the foundation. At the end of the dirt drive, there was a detached single-car garage with its door padlocked shut. Edna had allowed me to borrow the quilt, and I carried it draped over one arm. The daisy print fabric had been pieced into the quilt in 7 adjoining sections. While it was true that the fabric might have been sold across the country, the coincidence was too striking to imagine it was unrelated. I couldn't find a bell, so I opened the wood frame screen and knocked on the glass pane in the front door. A moment passed, and then a woman peered out. She was thin and unkempt, with pale green eyes and pale flyaway hair. Her cheeks and the rim of her nose were patterned with spider veins. She smoothed her hair with a knobby-fingered hand, tucking a loose strand into a disordered chignon before she opened the door a crack.
"Yes?"
"Mrs. Sanders?" She wore faded jeans and a red nylon sweater with a runner up one sleeve where a loop of yarn had come loose. I could smell whiskey fumes seeping through her pores like toxic waste. She hesitated, apparently unwilling to confirm or deny her identity, until she knew why I asked.
"I don't buy door-to-door," she said.
I held up the quilt. "I'm not selling anything. I came to talk to you about this." Her gaze shifted, though her manner remained fuzzy and her eyes were slightly out of focus. She looked like someone chronically inebriated.
"Where'd you get that?"
"Edna McPhee let me borrow it. I'm returning it later, but I have some questions for you first."
"Why'd she send you over here?"
"She said since you made the quilt, you might have some information. May I come in?" Medora thought about that briefly, probably wishing I'd go somewhere else.
"I hope this won't take long. I got other things to do."
She opened the door and I stepped directly into the living room, which was small and cramped, with an acoustic tile ceiling and a stingy-looking brick fireplace. On the mantel there was a cluster of statuettes, angels, milkmaids, and coy-looking kids with the toes of their shoes turned in. Medora closed the door, saying,
"That Edna's a pill. I don't know how Justine manages to put up with her."
"The two of you don't get along?"
"I never said that. Edna's a good person, and I know she means well, but she's holier than thou. You know the type. Doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, and doesn't hold with those who do."
"Cornell smokes."
"Not around his mother. He's pure as the driven snow," Medora said. "She disapproves of cards, too. Devil's handiwork, she says. Granddaughters come here, we play canasta, war, fish, slapjack. Doesn't seem like the devil's work to me."
She returned to the couch and sat dead center, causing the cushions to rise on either side of her. A crocheted green and black afghan was bunched haphazardly at one end. There was an ashtray full of butts on the coffee table, a cluster of prescription pill bottles, a fifth of Early Times, and a highball glass half-filled with melting ice cubes. Many surfaces looked sticky, and there was a fine haze of dust over everything.
"I was taking a little nap. I haven't been feeling well the last couple of days. What's your name again?"
I should have introduced myself. "I'm Kinsey Milhone."
"Medora Sanders," she said. "But I guess you know that. What's your connection to Edna? I hope it's not through her church. She's always trying to get me roped in."
"Not at all. Mind if I sit?" She waved me into a chair. I moved aside a stack of newspapers and took a seat, keeping the quilt on my lap. There were a number of crafts projects in the room, most from kits, by the look. A wall-hung quilt, embroidered pillows on the couch. In front of the hearth, there was a hand-hooked rug bearing the image of a Scotty. There were several framed cross-stitched pieces voicing corny sentiments. She followed my survey.
I used to do a lot of needlework until my joints flared up.
She lifted her right hand, displaying a twisted thumb and fingers that did a slow curve outward. It looked like she'd been tortured for information she'd refused to give.
I don't quilt anymore in case you want one for yourself.
I folded a section of the quilt until the daisy print fabric was foremost. Actually, I'm curious about this fabric. Do you remember where you got it? She glanced at the print.
I used to make clothes for my daughter.
She reached for a pack of Camels and extracted one. She flicked her lighter, but it took her two tries to make the flame touch the tip of the cigarette.
That was a remnant. Cheaper to buy that way. I used to check the bin at the fabric shop in town. It's gone out of business now, so you can save yourself a trip. Same time I bought that, I picked up 6 yards of royal blue taffeta that I offered to run up for Justine's prom dress. She about had a cow. Said she'd kill herself before she wore anything homemade. She insisted on store-bought, so I made her pay for it. It's like I told her, money doesn't grow on trees, Justine. Kids these days don't appreciate that.
They're embarrassed, I said. They want exactly the same clothes every other teenager has. That's how they express their unique individuality.
I guess. I had to make do with Precious Little once her dad ran out.
When was that?
Summer of 1969. Somewhere around in there. Who keeps track? Fellow wants to take a hike, it's good riddance.
She reached for one of her pill bottles and shook out a white tablet that she placed on her tongue. She picked up her highball and took a swallow, frowning slightly when she realized how watered down it was.
I'm on pain medication. Whiskey gives the codeine a little boost. Any rate, what's this in relation to?
I'm trying to identify a young woman who was murdered during that same period. When the body was found, she was wearing home-sewn pants made of the same daisy print. Medora's laugh was like a cough, hacking and full of phlegm.
I don't know about a murder, daisy print or no, but I can tell you one thing. You got a big job ahead. Company must have made thousands of yards of that print.
I'm sure you're right, but I thought it was worth a shot. The girl I'm referring to would have been somewhere between 15 and 18. This was late July, early August of 1969. About 5'4", 125 pounds. Brunette hair, she probably dyed blonde. She had prominent teeth, and the eye tooth on this side was twisted. She'd had a lot of dental work done. Her smile had begun to fade. Does any of that sound familiar? Medora crossed her arms and squinted against the smoke, cigarette held close to her face.
Years ago, I had a girl living with me. Sounds like that. Name was Cherise Quinn.
I felt my heart thump twice from the hit of adrenaline that shot through my veins. I'd run across the name before, but I wasn't sure where. What happened to her?
Nothing as far as I know, except she flew the coop. I went in her room one morning and found her bed hadn't been slept in, and half her stuff was gone. She'd helped herself to my best suitcase, too. Of course, she stole just about anything wasn't nailed down.
The murdered girl I'm talking about was found in Lompoc. You know the area?
Up near San Francisco?
Not that far north, closer to Santa Teresa.
Couldn't prove it by me. I don't travel. Used to, but now I prefer to stay put.
Why was she living in your home?
I was a foster mom, something like that. Reason she ended up with me is I had this woman live next door asked if I'd help. She'd had a whole string of foster kids trooping through her place. County wanted her to take Cherise, but her husband wasn't well, and it was more than she could manage. She asked if I could open my home, that's how she put it, open my home to someone less fortunate than myself. What a joke. Wilbur barely gave me enough to cover all the household expenses. At any rate,
My neighbor told me social services paid close to $180 a month, so that's why I agreed. Doesn't sound like much, but every little bit helped.
How'd the arrangement work out?
Not that good. Girl was foul-mouthed and disrespectful. Though at that age, I'll be the first to admit Justine was the same. Her and me had troubles enough without Charisse sticking in her 2 cents worth.
How long was she with you?
5-6 months, I'd guess. I believe she came here early March.
Can you remember the date she disappeared? Medora made a sour face.
I never said she disappeared. I said she took off.
Sorry, that's what I meant. When did she take off?
July, I'd say. Doesn't surprise me to hear she came to a bad end. She's a wild one, that girl. Had a bad case of hot pants. Picked up boys every chance she got. Out until all hours, she'd come waltzing in here 3 in the morning, smelling like cream de menthe and marijuana. I warned her and warned her, but would she listen to me?
What happened to her parents?
Dunno. I never laid eyes on that pair. Must have been druggies or something if the state had to step in.
How old was Charisse?
17, same as Justine. Girls were both seniors. Of course, Charisse got kicked out of regular high school and sent over to Lockerbie. That's the school for dummies and delinquents.
Bemused, I thought back to my conversation with Eichenberger, the principal of Quorum High, who'd sworn up and down he remembered every student who'd ever passed through his doors. What a pompous old windbag. Charisse had not only been there, but she'd caused enough trouble to get tossed out. You have other children?
Just the one.
And you were living here at the time?
I lived here ever since Wilbur and I got married in 1951. We only have the 2 bedrooms, so the girls had to share. Imagine how popular that was.
Must have been hard.
Oh, they went through every kind of conflict. Spats over clothes and boyfriends. The 2 went round and round like alley cats, spitting and hissing, fur flying. Oh, you never heard the like. Justine didn't want Charisse hanging out with her friends, and I could see her point. Always had to raise a fuss. Always had to have her way.
Not much of a charmer from the sound of it.
Oh, she could be charming once she put her mind to it, but only if she wanted something.
What about your husband? Where was he?
Well, he lived here in theory, but he was gone half the time.
What sort of work?
He hired on at Sears and Major Appliances. Dishwashers, refrigerators, things like that. Worked nights, weekends, and every holiday. Never got us a deal, but that was him in a nutshell. You'd think he could have got me a portable dishwasher at the very least. I had to do everything by hand. Probably why my joints went bad. Made my back hurt, too.
So he left about the same time she did?
I suppose so, though I never thought of it like that.
She frowned at me, taking a drag of her cigarette.
I hope you're not saying he went off with her.
I don't know, but it does seem odd. If she was so hot for guys, why not him?
He was close to 50 years old, for one thing. And I can't think why he'd take an interest in someone her age. He never paid any attention to her, as far as I could see. He's a skunk, that's for sure. But I can't believe he'd sink that low. That's, what do you call it? Statutory rape.
Did he give you any explanation when he left? She took another drag of her cigarette.
None. He went off to work one day, and he never came home. He left before she did, now I think of it. I remember because he missed seeing Justine in her prom dress, and that was June 14th.
What did you do when he left?
Nothing. Gone is gone, she said.
What about Charisse? Did you talk to the police when you realized she'd left?
I went to see them that day, police and the sheriff. I got county funds for her, and I knew the social worker would have a fit otherwise. As it was, I had to return the next month's check, and with Wilbur gone, I came up short on the bills.
Justine tried to tell me Charisse wasn't to blame, but it was typical of her. She'd do anything she could to screw it up for someone else.
But you did file a missing persons report?
I told you, that day. Though the deputy didn't offer much encouragement. He found out she'd run off half a dozen times before, and like he said, with her 18th birthday coming up, she'd be on her own anyway. Said they'd do what they could, but he couldn't promise much. He as good as told me to go home and forget about her.
Which you did.
What else could I do? I didn't even know her mother's name. I guess the social worker called the mother.
You think that's where she went? Back to her mom?
Don't know and didn't care. With Wilbur gone, I had my hands full just trying to make ends meet. In case you intend to ask, I never heard from her again. Him either. Far as I know, we're still married, unless he's dead. That'd be something, wouldn't it?
You have reason to think something might have happened to him?
I'm saying, if he's alive, you'd think he could have dropped us a card. 36 years married, that's the least he could do.
What about Charisse's social worker? What was her name?
Don't remember. It's been so many years. Tinker, Taylor, something along those lines. I called and talked to her, and you know what she said? Said she never expected the arrangement to last. Charisse was such a pain. Not those words exactly, but that's the gist of it. I thought, oh, thanks. Now she pipes up after all I went through.
You must have felt terrible. She coughed a thick laugh into her fist, pausing then to cough in earnest. She took a sip of watery bourbon and then recovered herself.
Especially when I found out Wilbur emptied all the bank accounts. Excuse me, are you done here? Because if not, I intend to fix myself another drink. See if I can get some relief from this cough. That was my mother's remedy, whiskey and honey. Though you ask me, it wasn't the honey that helped.
Just a few more questions, and then I'll let you get some rest. How did Charisse travel? Do you have any idea?
Wasn't by bus. I know, because police checked on that. I suppose she hitched a ride with one of those hoodlums she ran around with when she got to Lockerbie.
You remember any of their names?
Couldn't tell one from the other. They were all the same skanky-looking boys with bad skin.
You heard about the car that was stolen from the back of Rule's shop?
Everybody heard. He was fit to be tied.
Is there any chance Charisse took it?
I doubt it. She didn't drive. Never passed the test. I offered to help her get her license, but she didn't get around to it. Afraid to fail, you ask me. Worried she'd end up looking like a fool.
How'd she get around if she didn't drive?
Bummed rides with Justine and Cornell and everyone else. That's another thing got on people's nerves. She was a mooch.
Did she work?
Her? Huh, that's a laugh. I couldn't even get her to pick up after herself.
I know I asked you this before, but is there any way you could pinpoint the date she left? Medora shook her head.
I was just glad to have her gone. Does seem queer to think she's been dead all these years. I pictured her married with kids, that, or living on the street. Oh, wonder who killed her.
That's what we're trying to find out. Do you have a photograph by chance? I'd be interested in seeing how she looked.
I don't, but you might ask Justine.
She paused, coughing again with such vigor it brought tears to her eyes.
Oh, I can't stand it. My throat's killing me. You want a drink?
No, thanks. I watched Medora pour herself some whiskey, her hands shaking so badly she could scarcely lift the glass to her lips. She swallowed with relief and then took two deep breaths.
Whew, that's better. Whiskey'll cure just about anything.
Well, I guess that's it. I can't tell you how much I appreciate your help.
You want my opinion? Whatever happened to her, she brought it on herself.
I was on my way down her walkway, heading for Dolan's car with a quilt over my arm, when I noticed a sedan had pulled in and parked at the curb. The door on the driver's side opened and a woman got out. She tucked her keys in her purse and she was halfway up the walk when she caught sight of me and stopped. Her gaze flicked to the quilt and then back to me. This had to be Justine.
She and Medora shared the same body type and the same pale flyaway hair. Though their features were unremarkable, I could see the resemblance, something in the shape of their narrow chins and their pale green eyes. Like her husband Cornell, she appeared to be in her mid-30s. "Excuse me, are you Justine McPhee?"
"Yes."
"My name's Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private det-"
"I know who you are. I believe we have you to thank for the foul mood my father-in-law's been in."
Her manner was an odd mixture of composure and agitation, her tone giving vent to something prickly lurking under the surface. "I'm sorry about that, but it couldn't be helped." She glanced toward the house.
"What are you doing here?"
"I was just chatting with your mother about Charisse." Her expression was vacant for an instant, and then I could see recognition spark.
"Charisse?"
"That's right. I don't know if Cornell mentioned this, but we're investigating a murder."
"That's what he told me. But surely you're not talking about her?"
"We don't have a positive ID yet, but it does look that way."
"I don't believe it. What happened?"
"She was stabbed, and her body was dumped outside of Lompoc. This was August of 69. The sheriff's detectives worked the case for months without progress. Now they've decided it's time to try again."
"But what brought you to Quorum? She was only here a few months."
"Following our noses. We were lucky to get some breaks."
"Like what? I'm sorry for all the questions, but none of this makes sense."
"I know it's tough to absorb," I said. "When I was at Edna's, I spotted the quilt and realized the dark blue daisy print was a match for the victim's home-sewn pants. Edna told me your mother made the quilt, so I came to see her." "You thought she'd run away?"
"Well, yes. It certainly didn't occur to me the poor girl was dead. I'm sure Cornell and his dad would have helped you if they'd known who it was."
"Let's hope that's true. At this point, we're trying to pin down events between the time she took off and the time her body was found."
"When was that again?"
"August 3rd. Your mother said she left in July, but she couldn't remember the exact date."
"Charisse came and went as she pleased. I didn't even realize she was gone until Mom started screaming about her suitcase. The pants you mentioned must have been the pair my mother made for me."
"Did you give her the pants, or did she take those too?"
"I wouldn't have given them to her. She always helped herself to my stuff."
"What about the other items she stole?"
"I don't remember anything specific. She had no scruples at all. She didn't care who she hurt as long as she got what she wanted. The kids at Quorum didn't want to have anything to do with her."
She adjusted the watch band on her wrist, glancing at the time as she did. "You have to go?"
"I'm sorry, but we're due at my in-laws for supper, and I still have to pick up the girls. I stopped by to see Mom because she hasn't been feeling well."
"What about tomorrow? I'd love to talk to you again."
"Oh, I don't think so. I wish I could help, but Rule's mad enough as it is. He'd have a fit if he knew I'd even said this much."
"You said he'd have been cooperative himself if he'd known it was her."
"I meant if he'd known about it up front. He's hard to predict, especially now that he thinks you've made a fool out of him."
"Well, give it some thought and let me know."
"I'd have to talk to Cornell. He's pissed off, too, because his dad blames him about the car."
"That's dumb. Rule's the one who took title and let it sit all those years."
"True, but I don't want to give him reason to come down on me. He complains enough as it is. He thinks I'm controlling." "Ha! Like he's not."
"He doesn't have to know. That's entirely up to you. I don't want you getting into trouble on my account."
"Trust me, I won't." "You have to watch your backside around him. He might seem harmless, but he's a snake."
"Well, I better let you go. I'm staying at the Ocean View. I'd appreciate your calling once you've talked to Cornell. He might have something to contribute even if you don't."
"I doubt it. He really only knew Charisse because of me."
"Speaking of that, your mother told me Charisse hung out with a bunch of